Peace, We Build It is a podcast about the Alliance for Peacebuilding and its network of over 130 organizations working globally in 181 countries to reduce and prevent violent conflict and build sustainable peace. Host Tanya Domi will interview AFP's global partners, expert guests, and policy advocates on how they tackle the challenging work of conflict prevention and peace building in a world riddled by increasing violent conflict and war. One of our guests today is Megan Corrado, the Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Alliance for Peacebuilding. She is an international lawyer and policy practitioner working to promote human rights, peacebuilding, gender mainstreaming, transitional justice, and post-conflict legal and governance reform. She currently serves as co-chair of the U.S. Civil Society Working Group on Women, Peace, and Security, as well as Vice President for Global Affairs with the Clearinghouse on Women's Issues and a member of the Global Gender Coalition's Co-Chairs Working Group. Our second guest is Dr. Shirley Graham, the Director of the Gender Equality Initiative in International Affairs and Associate Professor of Practice in International Affairs at the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs. Her current research focuses on the role of U.S. military gender advisors, gender and peacekeeping, women in peacebuilding, and women's storytelling in peace and security. As a practitioner, she is an executive committee member of the U.S. Civil Society Working Group on Women, Peace, and Security, a coalition of experts serving to inform and educate the U.S. Congress, the Biden-Harris administration, and civil society on women, peace, and security thematic areas and issues. The Peace We Build It podcast today will be joined by these guests who are deeply engaged in the research and advancement of a centered women's peace and security foreign policy agenda. They argue in a recent opinion editorial why the United States is uniquely situated to become a global gender superpower after years of building a women's peace and security infrastructure within the U.S. government. This infrastructure can deploy a feminist-centered U.S. foreign policy under the Biden-Harris administration. The data with respect to women's lack of equality points to ubiquitous deprivation of women's rights affecting numerous sectors across the globe. 35% of women will experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetimes. 45% of countries constrain women's labor rights. 30% of countries restrict women's freedom of movement. And globally, women only enjoy 3/4 of the rights afforded to men. Moreover, if women were able to equally participate in the workplace, it could add up to $28 trillion to the global economy and enhance the quality of life of their families and communities. Lastly, the Council on Foreign Relations has indicated during the past 20 years, only 6% of the mediators or signatories of peace negotiations and 13% of negotiators included women's representation. Megan Corrado and Shirley Graham, welcome to the Peace We Build It podcast.
Thank you, Tanya. Great to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So today we're going to be talking about a women's peace and security U.S. foreign policy. What is the women's peace and security agenda? Could you start us off, Megan?
Sure. And thanks again for hosting us. We appreciate it. The Women, Peace, and Security agenda, you know, it evolved out of UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which was passed in 2000. So here we are in the anniversary year. And really, it seeks to recognize the critical role that women play in peace building, peace sustaining, post-conflict, and crisis recovery activities. It recognizes the fact that women experience conflict and crisis different than men. And it calls for a gendered perspective in peace and security policy. What does that mean? Again, taking into the individual context in which women experience conflicts and crisis, you know, women can be combatants. They can be victims of war crimes. They can be, you know, human trafficked in the middle of conflict. So it's really sort of taking in all these different experiences into account instead of just looking at as, you know, a government and an armed movement getting together to talk about peace.
In your thoughts, Dr. Graham?
Well, what was very exciting about the Women, Peace and Security Agenda when it was originally created was, believe it or not, in the year 2000, it was the first time that women civil society organizations were allowed into the Security Council chambers. So I think that in itself, while 20 years ago to many of our listeners will sound like and will be a lifetime ago, I think it's important to note that, you know, this is fairly recent history in terms of its creation and its evolution. And so while this is a key milestone in terms of women's rights and transnational feminist movement and activism across the globe, there is a lot of work still to be done. So it's still very much in its infancy in terms of what it has achieved thus far, which is quite limited. And we can talk more about that in a moment. But it has put new important language on the policy agenda. And it really has highlighted these issues of, you know, gender, gender roles, gender norms, the fact that women and men experience conflict differently, that that heightens vulnerability around certain types of harms and violences, and then what needs to be done in relation to ensuring women's inclusion in conflict prevention and all, you know, peace and security formal processes. Because we know women have always been there. Women are 50% of the population. They've always been part of the conflict or of the peace. They've always been involved in the security. But very often, this has been at an informal or grassroots level, and that hasn't been given credit, or it hasn't been given voice or the access to the formal decision-making processes. So what the agenda does is it creates a framework for national governments and for women's movement to call for women to be included in all those processes and for women's experiences to be listened to and to shape policy responses.
Yes, and 1325 hasn't sat. It has actually evolved. And I know that in 2019, it was updated, UN Security Council Resolution 2467, which a lot of people have pointed to. There's been some critique of it saying, well, it's not probably not as strong as it should be, but yet it still has evolved and it's still been brought up again in the Security Council. And I mean, let's also acknowledge that UN Women, it seems, came out of 1325, the establishment of UN Women. And the fact is that you have a convening space. Also, it's part of the UN infrastructure, the architecture of the UN. So that's really important. As I think we'll acknowledge probably more and more in this conversation, is the danger of being siloed and not being integrated across architecture, whether it's the UN system or it's the United States government or any government for that matter. That's just kind of what I see is part of the challenge. So speaking of which, it's a good segue to this next question is, what are the weaknesses of the Women's Peace and Security Agenda?
So there are many, unfortunately. But I suppose the first weakness that feminists have pointed to consistently is the lack of focus on the prevention of conflict. And
instead of the reaction, right?
Exactly.
Response. Yeah.
Exactly. So the four pillars of Resolution 1325, so the seminal resolution in the agenda, those four pillars were focused on prevention of conflict and women's role in the prevention of conflict, women's participation in peace and security processes, protection of women and girls from violence, and also protection of their human rights and women's inclusion, obviously, in relief and recovery post-conflict. But this prevention piece has really not been given the focus and the attention. And that was the main driving point of the feminist movement and the women's movement, was around ending violent resolutions to conflict. And putting on the UN Security Council agenda the fact that, you know, who's peace and what is peace and how do we define peace? Right. If women are not included, and if women are not included in these formal peace processes. So that piece on the prevention of conflict, or the lack of attention on that, I should say, is one of its key flaws.
Megan, do you have any other comments?
Sure, no, that's a critical point, Shirley, and thank you for raising that. You know, I think another major issue, and you sort of alluded to this, Tanya, is the fact that the WPS agenda gets very siloed, both within the international community, international institutions, and also our own governments. And mainly that's because it's seen as a women's issue. So the siloing off in terms of policy and law and programming has really harmed the advancement of the agenda. It needs to be integrated across all sectors, across defense, across security, across policing, across health, across development, all of these different, you know, considerations. You can't have just one or the other. They're all inextricably linked. It's been really difficult for the agenda to move forward on an implementation level. And of course, it all comes down to funding too.
Right.
Because it's siloed, and because it's thought of as a soft issue, it doesn't get the funds and the money necessary.
Don't you think this is also part of the cultural context? We're talking about types that are hard security types. We're talking about military, police, you know, UN peacekeeping. Having been out in the field myself and being in missions, it's, you know, really dominated by men who are former military or current military. And secondly, you're talking about hard security issues. And so they see women as being part of soft power and not necessarily part of this discussion. And they, as you pointed out, they're always on the outside and they're not at the table. If you look at a class picture from any European gathering, and I look at Europe because I am a Europeanist myself, you'll see there's like no women. I mean, there's very few women, and you're talking about diplomats in a European context. You see very few women, any women in those pictures, and, you know, see one or two heads of state or prime ministers here and there. And so therefore, women really are not at the table. They're not in power and they're on the outside. And that's the danger of siloing for sure.
The other problem is that the Women, Peace and Security agenda hasn't historically focused enough on gender roles, gender norms, gender relationships, gender dynamics. So
right.
You know, these power inequalities that are at the heart of the construction of gender in different cultures across the globe. And by excluding men and masculinities, and this conversation amongst and between different genders, again, you're siloing women and focusing on women, and that sets up a protectionist discourse.
Right.
Back to what you were saying about hard security and military security, it actually feeds into a militarized perspective of the Women, Peace and Security agenda, which is about protecting women from those other men over there,
right?
Rather than looking at issues of gender equality within these different contexts.
Right.
That would be another key flaw, not really focusing on the structural root causes of the gender inequality, nor bringing in LGBTQ plus populations as a key area of concern would be another flaw, for example.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I would say that if you're in the academy, for example, and you have feminist approach, you're looking at an intersectional diagnosis of an issue, right? And so we're talking about this situation where, having been in both worlds, that they just don't think that way. Men just don't think that way in terms of integrating women across the board and, of course, minorities like national minorities, national ethnic minorities, LGBTQ. I mean, those people are just not included. And I know that some of the work I did in the OSCE actually has done some work on advancing women being at the peace table, but I'm not saying that it's where it should be. As you said, surely there's a lot more work that has to be done, but I'm glad that we're putting all of this into context. And so that goes to the next question, I think, about having people within the architecture, and the creation of gender advisor roles was one of the key developments of the Women, Peace, and Security agenda. And so how can they play a pivotal role in elevating this agenda and an orientation towards not protection of women, but actually women as active actors in the process?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to this idea of, you know, women as agents of change in their own lives, not as victims, and focusing on the fact it was women who brought about this agenda, the Women, Peace and Security agenda, and women's activism and women's leadership. And so when we're thinking about the role of gender advisors, which is an important development that came out of this agenda, is the creation of gender advisors and gender focal points and the work that they do, you know, with different partner countries and security forces, for example, or within UN peacekeeping missions or different types of peacekeeping missions. But for example, in security cooperation endeavors, gender advisors really are there to advocate on behalf of gender equality and women's rights within those particular countries that they are operating. So it could be that they are supporting, for example, the national government. Say, for example, the gender advisor working in Afghanistan would be supporting the government to implement its national action plan on women, peace and security, and to work with the government around the nuances in relation to gender sensitivity, gender perspectives, gender training, those types of understanding. So the gender advisor is really there advocating on behalf of women and gender minorities and to ensure that they are included within all the processes of that particular government or the security forces that they're working with. So, for example, they could be designing recruitment campaigns to increase the numbers of women recruited into a security forces, or a training programs to help women move up the ranks within those particular defense forces. Or it could be around putting in place policies to protect women from sexual harassment or assault within the security forces. So the gender advisors are really there, you know, with this awareness and guiding, putting in place, you know, plans and rolling out those plans to guide these new constructions so that women can really be in elevated positions within these forces.
Megan, what are your thoughts about the role of gender advisors? And
I know Shirley, she's unearthed a lot of experiences where the gender advisors are able to bring different perspectives to the situations and what they're working in. You know, they're kind of looking at things like, oh, well, how do I help this woman be a part of the security forces if she needs childcare? There's a really difficult challenge with economic opportunity for women in the village or city or town in which they work. Hey, what if we open up a childcare, you know, facility with the women from town so the women in the military can go to work? You know, so it's kind of solving social issues at the same time of ensuring meaningful participation of these women in partner countries. So, you know, they really bring a dynamic that maybe, you know, wasn't there before. But just to take a step back for a moment, you know, just to kind of outline the history and how we got here, you know, the United States passed the National Action Plan in 2011, updated in 2016, passed the very first Women, Peace and Security Act in 17, came up with a strategy in 2019 and implementation plans in 2020. DOD, DHS, State Department, USAID all are the four implementing agencies. DOD has been the first agency to actually receive funding. They received money for the gender advisors. You know, they've actually taken the lead. and sort of demonstrated how this model can work, because we want to see gender advisors across all four agencies. There's opportunities for those different perspectives and all the different competencies those agencies have. But I think the good work that's been happening so far has, you know, given Congress confidence. They finally did give a little bit more money this year to the other agencies as well. But now I think what we need to do with the gender advisors in DOD and you know, across the board, is to make sure that they're getting the institutional support they need from the top down. Mm-hmm. So the leadership mm-hmm. needs to be trained in WPS principles so that, you know, they can empower the gender advisors, and, you know, and then the gender advisors can come back to them with challenges, gaps, opportunities that they're seeing on the ground. So it needs to be sort of a top down and down up cultural change.
I have a question about that. Is it in civilian capacity, or is it also in uniform in DOD, those gender advisor roles?
I believe it's been both so far.
Yeah. Very interesting. I can't even tell you what that means. You have to know that I was in the military from 1974 to 1990. So I saw it change dramatically, but in the years since, it's also changed. I cannot, that's revolutionary. I want you both to know that is revolutionary.
Absolutely. DOD, I will give them a lot of credit. Shirley and I are both part of a big group called the U.S. Civil Society Working Group on Women, Peace, and Security. There's over 52 organizational members. The Secretariat resides within the United States Institute of Peace. They came to us while they were drafting their implementation plans back in 2019, and said, hey, what do we need to put in here? They thought of that, which is really great. And we are a group of experts that is willing to help. That's what we do. We educate, raise awareness, sort of try to feed into policy. We're not an advocacy group, but really just try to inform the U.S. government, civil society about what's happening in the agenda. And they came to us originally. We were able to review their plan, gave them additional recommendations. And just a few weeks ago, they came back to us again and said, hey, let's check in. So USIP is actually hosting a town hall with DOD tomorrow to talk about sort of progress in the implementation of the plans. And, you know, I think there is an opportunity. You know, you talk to a lot of commanders and they say, hey, if we can create sustainable peace, you know, including women throughout the process, that means my soldiers,
less deployment,
my sailors, yeah, they're not putting themselves in harm's way as much. So anything we can do to create more stability and peace, mm-hmm. they're all for. So I really think there's an opportunity, particularly within DOD, to advance the agenda.
Well, I will say this about the DOD. I think a lot of ground was plowed, and here's why. First of all, you had the integration of women into overall forces. They opened up the combat arms. And secondly, the work that we did on LGBT, and I was one of the national leaders in 93 on advancing the reversal of the full ban. And then we ended up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And then 17 years later, it was revoked by through the help of President Obama. And then we went into the trans open service, which I also worked on with an advocacy group that was successful as well. So there's been a lot of work, a lot of water over the rock, so to speak, on these issues. And you have to give them credit for that, because whether or not they, and believe me, in the beginning, you know, they absolutely refused. I mean, President Clinton was told, you know, that he should not be commander in chief. I mean, Colin Powell went on the New York Times op-ed page and said, President Clinton's wrong about this gay lesbian thing. And so I can believe it. I can believe what you're telling me. And it's a reasonable outcome given the history of that institution and the work it's done on minorities within its ranks, and the full integration of women into the force as well. I'll just say that. That's my observation. So, but you were just speaking about Dr. Graham and her field research. So why don't we talk next about what's at stake for women, peace, and security agenda in the Afghanistan context. We know that the Secretary of Defense just made a visit. They announced a 6-month delay. That decision was supposed to come down on May 1st. I think that the Biden administration is buying some time so they can get their heads around what the options are in terms of whether troops stay or remain, or they're reduced or whatever. But the women's peace and security agenda is like inclusive to this situation. What are your thoughts, Dr. Graham?
Absolutely. So this particular context and this setting is a key one, and it's a, you know, it's an important moment in terms of seeing how the Women, Peace and Security Act of 2017, adopted here in the US, and the strategy and the implementation plans are actually going to play out in reality in a context where they are sorely needed. So we have Afghani women asking for the international community to ensure that not only the rights that they have gained over the past 20 years are maintained, but to help them advance those rights, you know, by working with women, by really, you know, funding women's grassroots organizations, supporting women's leadership, really listening to the voices of women and ensuring that their experiences of the conflict are included within all the peace negotiations, and that women, as just over 50% of the population of Afghanistan, are equally and fairly included within this process. So all eyes are on this particular process to see what the US government will do in relation to ensuring that these gains do continue and supporting women in Afghanistan.
And your thoughts, Megan?
No one has more to lose than Afghan women in this situation. And they've done the hard work. You know, they lived under absolutely, you know, oppressive conditions under the Taliban. And, you know, they benefited the most probably from intervention, but they took advantage of it. And, you know, I worked with Afghan women for a long time, and a saying that we often circulated around the community was, if you give an Afghan woman an inch, she'll go a mile. And I saw it time and time again. A little bit of training, next minute, you know, she's an entrepreneur feeding her entire community. You know, it has
That's amazing.
It has this multiplier effect, because again, you give them any bit of assistance or an opportunity, they know what it's like not to have anything. So they have made tremendous strides over the last 20 years. And they are smart, they are resilient, they are articulate, they know what they want. They've lost the most as well through 4 decades of conflict.
Right.
You know, they're the widows, they're the ones that have lost their sons and uncles and brothers.
I mean, so this goes back to the British, you know, the British before the Russians.
Right. So it's been really like centuries, millennia. Sort of the kind of cradle of civilization there. But I really think, you know, U.S. credibility is on the line. Here we are. We've been a leader in putting our national action plans forward, our legislation forward. Now we have these strategy and plans. This is the test case. This is it. This is the ball game. This is what we've all been working towards. You know, we've demonstrated our commitment, at least on paper, to the WPS agenda. Now it's time to show up. And I have to say, I don't think we have just yet. Ambassador Khalilzad says all the right things, you know, kind of supports women, at least in front of the podium, but is he bringing women into the room right now? Is he helping to facilitate that conversation? I don't see it. And I do think it's at an institutional level. I think he's not speaking to, you know, the Global Women's Issues Office and State Department. I don't think he's consulting with gender advisors from DOD and other agencies. So I really think that's a problem. And they have an opportunity to fix that right now. You know, okay, Biden administration wants to take a step back and reset and kind of figure out their way forward. I can respect that, but now it's time for them to do something different, because this is just a continuation of what was going on under the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there
should be... If you want a different result, you need to take different actions to facilitate that result. So,
do you think there needs to be different U.S. representation there?
I mean, people have lots of thoughts on that.
Okay.
On that landmine. But I will say too, you know, it's not just about our commitment in terms of the act, but it's also in terms of our commitment to our development process. The training, the assistance that we've given our US aid and all our development dollars that have gone to women have proven a worthy investment. And it should be a model in terms of empowering women, empowering local actors. But if we either walk away or don't meaningfully work to include women in every facet of the peace building and hopefully peace sustaining activities, then that those trillions of dollars that we invested are going to be for naught. It's just going to revert right back to Taliban rule. So why did we spend all that money, you know, all that time?
And shed blood and treasure too, I might add. I would also ask. I'm sure that there are advocates on the Hill, there are members in the Congress and in the Senate that are going to support organizations like the AFP and everybody that's involved in this women's peace and security agenda setting. And I would think that getting pressure on the State Department and the DOD is just critical. And, you know, line your people up, get talking to Samantha Power too. I mean, you're right. This is the ballgame. That's a really good way to encapsulate it, Megan. This is the whole enchilada as well, I might add. And this
and it's a bipartisan issue. There's a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. There's a fairly newly created caucus. The WPS caucus came into being last year. Yeah, I always tell everyone it was the last public event I went to last March before shutdown, where we were like, oh, do we give elbow bumps? Do we foot tap? Like, what are we doing here? But, you know, it's a great launch, bipartisan, led by Representative Frankel and Representative Waltz. It's grown fairly.
Oh, Frankel's great. Lois Frankel's great.
She is. Members now. So, you know, definitely for folks listening to this, encourage your representatives to join. So it's not only the WPS agenda has a lot of bipartisan support. It has the Afghan women's cause has a lot of support. So I do think there's a real opportunity on the Hill to put pressure on the administration.
Yeah, and I think also there's an understanding by those representatives that this is not only critical for Afghani women, this is critical for all of Afghanistan. This is critical in terms of democracy, and it's critical in terms of peace in the region, and obviously across the world. So this is an issue that is going to have, and continues to have, I should say, a huge effect on international security. I mean, just to say, there are only four women negotiators on the Afghan government side currently.
And there are four.
Four women involved in the negotiations currently. And so none on the Taliban side. So, you know, this obviously is a huge concern for Afghan women themselves in terms of, you know, how are they being represented? And again, women are not a monolithic block. Women are, you know, are diverse, and there's lots of different perspectives and experiences depending on the region, urban, rural women's experiences, different religious groups, ethnic groups, etc. But I think one of the areas that, you know, the U.S. administration really needs to look at is tying aid, for example, to certain benchmarks, girls' access to education moving forward, you know, after, you know, as part of the peace process and in terms of maintenance of peace and security in that region, as well as women's participation in the workforce and, you know, women to be able to continue enjoying political participation and being able to exercise their fundamental human rights. In the last couple of months alone, 20 women were murdered.
Yes, I've read this, and there was a woman journalist just assassinated, right?
Yes, I believe so. Journalists, yes. Judges, doctors, yes. Teachers. This is obviously a deliberate tactic by the Taliban, by ISIS, to really strike fear into the hearts and minds of women and to, you know, send out a very clear message. So we need to support these human rights defenders in very, very concrete ways, whether it is, you know, through naming and shaming, through sanctions, but we really need to make sure those women know that they are being supported, that it is not just going to be words, that there are actions behind those words, and that their needs and their human rights are being prioritized.
Well, we will watch. I'm sure that you won't be watching. Both of you will probably be very engaged on the advocacy front. This is a time for op-eds. This is a time for podcasts. This is the time to really lay it on out there. And this speaks to our next question, is that how can the U.S. leadership role ensure that women's rights are not only maintained but advanced? And I would just offer, you know, Tony Blinken just made his first visit to the NATO Ministerial Council. And, you know, NATO remains the Atlantic Alliance main security mechanism. And I just wonder what's going on in NATO with respect to the WPS efforts. And that's just one convening area. There's other multilateral ones, including like OSCE and the UN. this is a big moment when instability and insecurity will result in the deaths of thousands. We only need to look at Syria and that situation, just how horrific the collapse of really Western leadership, as far as I'm concerned, on the question of Syria and the failure in Afghanistan would really destabilize the region as well. So what does the U.S. need to do, in both of your opinions, from your platforms and from your positions, what is really important now with this new administration trying to recover from a disaster of destruction, I think, of U.S. soft power for sure. U.S. hard power is always there, but when you have to resort to hard power, that means you've lost the soft power efforts. So I'd like to hear your thoughts, both of you, on what is necessary now in this moment from U.S. leadership. Megan, you want to?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head. We are at a really precarious moment. You know, COVID-19 has exacerbated all of the conflict drivers and things that bring us to violence and war around the world. You're going to see a 56% increase in violent conflicts around the world than the forecast predicted through 2022. You know, we're calling it stabilization and revolt in reverse. You've had an inability of development programs to be implemented during this time. You've seen backsliding of democracies around the world and the rise of autocratic tendencies, just a squashing of human rights, of course, and women's rights. So there are no shortage of challenges for this administration. And again, you know, highlighting that coming into sort of a retreat from U.S. leadership over the last couple of years. I think they're doing a couple right things, you know, having Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield at the UN, having a woman sends a great message. Having Vice President Harris there, she gave a great speech at the CSW a few weeks ago. You know, assuming Ambassador Powers is confirmed, you'll have three women at really high level positions. So use that. They're brilliant. They're accomplished. You know, let's use their experiences and make sure that the United States isn't, you know, saying folks around the world should be following our lead if we're not following our own lead. We need to, you know, not do as I say as I do. They need to, right. They need to do it. So we need to implement the WPS agenda within our ranks. We need to make sure we're putting women in leadership positions, not just necessarily at the ambassador level, but throughout leadership, throughout the middle ranks, throughout, the, you know, they need to be empowered and given, and, you know, given opportunities to move upwards. They need to be doing training with men. We need to, you know, you have to bring along the other half too. So it needs to be training from the leadership to, you know, the boot camp days within the DoD, for instance. You know, at Foreign Service training, at State Department, they need to be understanding what WPS principles are. So really it needs to be both, again, top down and bottom up. And then, you know, working with our allies. I know NATO has been doing a series of consultations on women, peace, and security with civil society around the world. So that's a really great model that could be something the United States could replicate, or at least work well with them, and extract the lessons that are gleaned from those consultations. You know, again, we need to invest. We need to invest money to support our staff and the personnel here. We need to be undertaking research, undertaking monitoring and evaluation. We need strong indicators and opportunities to learn from the programs that are going forward to create better ones in the days ahead. So, you know, let's do what we can within our own institutions and make sure that, again, WPS gender is not a siloed, you know, issue or policy. It needs to be integrated across the whole of government and supported from the top.
And you, Dr. Graham, your thoughts about U.S. leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think Megan has said it out really, really clearly, but I think just to build on that and to kind of reiterate a point that we made in our recent op-ed piece on the USIP website is we're talking about the US developing a feminist foreign policy, you know, really right. Putting women's rights and the rights of gender and sexual minorities at the heart of all foreign policy making. So, you know, going back to what we were talking about in terms of the Women, Peace and Security agenda, taking, you know, those gender perspectives and the knowledge and what we now know in relation to conflict and security and how it is gendered and its impacts, and making sure that that is included across all the different government departments. So currently, as we've mentioned, you know, USAID, State Department, Department of Defense, and Department of Homeland Security been tasked with the implementation of the Women, Peace and Security strategy. And so making sure that these are not siloed, that these are in conversation with each other, that there is a focus on, you know, disarmament within, you know, the work that we are doing in relation to post-conflict reconstruction, and that we're not looking at military response as the first response, that, you know, we're really focusing on diplomacy, we're focusing on human rights and democratization. So really looking at how a feminist foreign policy could be adopted by the US, following in the footsteps of Sweden, for example, with their feminist foreign policy. They were the first country to adopt a feminist foreign policy. Canada, with its development feminist foreign policy. Mexico now as well has a feminist foreign policy. So we have other examples of feminist foreign policies and how they can work and really elevate women's rights and these issues that we've been talking about today.
So those points, these are very spot on in my view. I mean, I agree with both of you. And I also think that we now have players, I think, women in the right places. And it appears that there was an analysis done recently about the role of Kamala Harris in foreign policy. And it seems like she has really upped her activity level and that she's very engaged, not necessarily always public facing, but more and more she is involved and apparently is cutting out a piece of work there. Somebody needs to go talk to her about your agenda. I'm just advising you as somebody who used to work on the Hill, somebody who used to be a lobbyist for human and civil rights. And I so appreciate it is refreshing, my friends, that you are bringing in the LGBTQ aspect, because there's so many of us that have been involved in government and couldn't always be out about it. And it's really incredible to know that the spokesperson at the State Department, Nick Price, is openly gay, for example. That's just one part of it. But there's a lot of women that are involved and have been leading these efforts in civil society, and many of them are lesbian or queer, as younger people refer to themselves. So I would just say I really appreciate that and your discourse. And speaking of which, let's go from that to pivot to the role in higher education in elevating a women, peace, and security agenda. And Shirley, I'm so impressed having read your CV and being also a colleague teaching at the School of International Public Affairs at Columbia, where I think the Elliott School has done incredible empowerment in hiring somebody like you, for example. I'd like to hear your thoughts and Megan's too.
Well, thank you very much for that, Tanya. But just going back to the point you were making a moment ago about Kamala Harris and the feminist agenda. I mean, she did recently on St. Patrick's Day last week, you know, it was widely reported, and particularly in Ireland, not surprisingly, that she met with Northern Ireland's First Minister, Arlene Foster, and Deputy First Minister, Michelle O'Neill. And she had these private meetings about the Belfast Good Friday peace agreement.
Excellent. That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah. So just these important moments that I think we need to magnify and highlight in relation to obviously the peace and security topics. But yes, when we talk about in higher education, it's really, really exciting to be working at the cutting edge in relation to this topic. And really, it's such a privilege because, Tanya, I get to meet every semester, a new cohort.
Yes.
Of, you know, smart, passionate, hardworking students who are excited about conducting research in this field and who want to make an impact, who want to put new policy items on the agenda, and who really have a lot of fresh thinking and new perspectives. So this is why we came up with the idea of the Student Consortium on Women, Peace and Security, because it creates a natural sort of connection and pipeline between the US Civil Society Working Group and students in the DC area who are focused on this topic of research. So for example, there are 18 universities who make up the consortia in DC.
18.
So, yeah.
Wow.
So we have a lot of, we've a lot of students and we've a lot of opportunity to create cross-fertilization of ideas, sharing of research, working together on the writing of policy briefs and reports, and then being able to connect those with practitioners, with experts, working in the field, on the ground, and supporting the work of civil society organizations. So that has been another key area of interest for me and for the students and obviously for the civil society working group as well.
That's fantastic. And Megan, I think you probably have interaction in your roles as well. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So the DC Student Consortium that Shirley's put together in no time at all, I think they probably had their first meetings in December, and they had an absolutely fabulous launch just a few weeks ago around Women's Day, where they brought in all different high-level speakers, panels. It was an all-day event. Even though it was virtual, we couldn't be together. It felt like we're all in the same room. It was wonderful. So I just want to give an immense amount of credit to Shirley for leading this amazing consortium and the students themselves that have really done the hard work and, you know, constituted themselves, created a leadership structure, organized this event and this consortium. So they've just been absolutely inspiring. And it's so necessary, you know. I'm not that far out of school, maybe 10, 11 years or so, but something like this didn't exist then. You know, we were still calling it women's studies. It wasn't gender studies yet. So
right.
Even having, you're changing the curriculum or changing the discourse that's going on in higher education, that's going to trickle up into the field. We're going to have folks that
absolutely
graduate college and their master's programs and law programs and are able to go into the field and have a great understanding of the WPS agenda and how it relates to the rest of foreign policy. So we need those folks in the field. We need them at the policy level. We need them in government. We need them, you know, doing advocacy. So all of a sudden we have a new generation prepared to hit the ground running while the rest of us were kind of catching up, once we were in the field. So it's an amazing opportunity that we're also bringing, you know, it's the next generation of leaders. So it's just absolutely inspiring.
Yeah, and I think also just to highlight the fact that, you know, it's this group of students who've highlighted four particular policy areas that they want to work on with civil society organizations in the CSWG.
And they get, and I imagine they're offered internships as well in the summer right?
So this is part of how it'll work together. So there'll be opportunities for internships, there'll be opportunities for policy brief writing with the civil society organizations, conducting research for and with them, potentially mentorship as well. Hopefully down the line, jobs.
That's fantastic.
Important. But I just want to highlight the areas that the students are focusing on and highlighted at the launch last week or the week before. Yes, it's all, this March is a bit of a crazy month. It all begins to blend together. But those four areas are what we're talking about, feminist foreign policy, you know, and how that works with the Women, Peace and Security agenda, LGBTQ plus understandings of foreign policy, engaging men and boys on gender equality issues in international security, and also looking at historical trauma and the intergenerational effects of it, particularly from a gendered perspective. So these are four areas of focus that the students in the consortium are particularly interested in conducting more research on and engaging with civil society organizations on as well to further those policy agendas. So it is, it's really, really exciting. And it's so energizing, as Megan was saying, to work with this next generation of leaders here in the US, but also internationally, of course.
Kudos to both of you. That's very exciting. That's an agenda that is really amazing. So you have them in the pipeline and they come out of grad school or even undergrad, I guess, and they're choosing graduate school or maybe they're going out into the field in entry level positions. That's really incredible. That's how education should be used and applied, and it's wonderful. So I think for today, at least, we've covered a lot of ground. I appreciate the conversation we've had. I want to continue a conversation with both of you. So thank you very much for your participation in this great topic of women, peace, and security agenda for the United States and for the world.
Thank you, Tanya. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thanks for tuning in to Peace We Build It. And thanks to our guest today, Megan Corrado, the Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Alliance for Peace Building, and Dr. Shirley Graham, a faculty member of the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs. The Peace We Build It podcast is made possible through the financial support of the Alliance for Peace Building, based in Washington, D.C. Tanya Domi is the host and Senior Fellow for Communications at the Alliance for Peace Building, and Kevin Wolf, the audio engineer, provides technical assistance. This podcast can be found on Spotify, Apple, and where all podcasts are found.